Welcome to the Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston, and we are on the eve of the 2015 Tour de France. It's always a really exciting time to look ahead to 3 weeks of bicycle racing around the world's most beautiful country. Here with me, down the line, in fact, from London, is Guy Andrews, author, photographer, former editor, founding editor of Ruler magazine. Guy, you're a regular on the Bike Show over the years, and always very interesting to hear what you have to say about the sport in general. This Tour de France does look like being a cracker. I mean, we kind of, in a way, we always say that. We always hope for that because we invest so much time in watching it. But looking at the course, looking at the riders, it does look like it has a lot of potential to be a very, very interesting and entertaining and unpredictable race.
That's the key thing, the unpredictability of it. I mean, it is wide open. We're coming into it with basically four fairly equal favourites, which is the first time in I don't know how long we've had that situation. There's not one that you can actually say, you know, as long as they stay upright, they're going to win it. And it has often been like that over the last sort of 10, probably even the last 20 years. There's four sort of out-and-out favourites there. Nairo Quintana, Chris Froome, Alberto Contador and Vincenzo Nibali, last year's winner. So they're all at the top of their game. They all seem to be coming into it with great form. So, yeah, it really is set up to be a humdinger.
Well, we'll come to the Fab Four, as I'm insisting on calling them, in a minute. But let's begin with the route, because that is kind of like the recipe or the menu of the tour that you look through and you browse at each stage, at 21 stages, and you think what kind of terrain they're going to be racing over. What is the course like? Is it an uphill finish? You know, what are the mountains like? What sequence are they in? In a way, it's always the same, 21 stages, and it goes around France and there are some key moments, but it's always different. And that's one of the delights of it. What are your impressions of the route this year?
I quite like the way that Prudhomme and the ASO put this one together, because they've sort of, it's like a sort of mini celebration of the classics a little bit to begin with. It starts obviously in Utrecht, where the prologue is, but then going through Belgium, the highlight of the first three stages is stage number three, which finishes up at the top of the Mer de Huy, which features in Flèche Wallonne, one of the early season hilly classics. The Mer de Huy comes at the end of a race that's through very twisty, narrow, technical roads, and it comes at the end of a very long day. And I think that's quite interesting, because it's only 160k. That stage is 100 miles. It, you know, they're going to reach the bottom of the Mer de Huy after about 3.5-4 hours. And I think that is going to be quite interesting if it's rainy, if it's a difficult day, if there's crosswinds. I think we could be in for a shake-up even as early as stage three.
What we can detect in the last few years, and I think this is definitely the Christian Prudhomme factor after he took over from Jean-Marie Leblanc as the supremo in race organizing for the ASO, is that they're putting a lot more interesting stuff, a lot more fireworks are being set up in the first week. I guess there was a view that maybe the first week was not exciting enough in the past, that they wanted to get the race going to begin with in a very dynamic and exciting way, and so putting in some cobbles, putting in uphill finishes, putting in routes that might have crosswinds and that kind of thing. Do you think that has had an impact on the race in a positive way? Because I guess there is a very obvious downside, which we saw last year, was that there was carnage. And we saw that in the last few years, in fact, that there's been a lot of crashes in the first week. I guess it's not just down to the route. But what's your take on the first week and the challenge of making an entertaining race, but not having too many wipeouts that ultimately take out leading contenders before they've really had a chance to stretch their legs?
There's two interesting points there. I mean, Thierry Gouvenou, who's the sort of technical director of the tour, who sort of basically plans the route, obviously with Prudhomme's direction, but he's an ex-racer himself. So he, and the way he raced, you know, he was very much a sort of an attacking sort of ruler sprinter type rider. So, you know, he loves all this sort of classic nods at parts of the Paris-Roubaix Park course and riding through, you know, Belgium is obviously going to be right up his street. So that sort of stuff is what he's all about. So I think he loves to bring in the routes from those races. But the second point, I think what's interesting, and we saw it last year with Mark Cavendish crashing out early in the UK, which was a terrible shame, because obviously, you know, everybody lined the route wanting to see Cav do well. But I think the pressure is on the teams to bring their best sprinters as well as their best GC contenders. And as a result, it gets very tense in the first few days, first few stages. And I think when there's so many very, very good sprinters, and obviously, you know, it's everyone at the top of their game, it means that the teams take a lot of risks to try and get them in the right position. And I think that's why we have the crashes. I don't necessarily think it's anything to do with the parkour. So I mean, obviously, that probably doesn't help sometimes, but I think generally speaking, it's because the riders take more risks, because there's so much more pressure on them to deliver their sprinter to the line first.
And are the lead-out trains starting much earlier in that jostling than they used to, in your experience?
They're a lot more organised, basically. They spend a lot more time in training, practising their manoeuvres, if you like. I would prefer to see a stage in that first week that maybe even goes into the mountains, because I just think it would kind of steady things down a little bit. I mean, it wouldn't for the GC contenders, but I think it probably would for riders like Mark Cavendish. But anyway, that would be to benefit them rather than to benefit the race as a whole. I don't know. I think traditionally the first week of, you know, sprints and flat exchanges are, you know, what we're used to. But having said that, you know, the Mörderhöj is a beast of a climb at the end of a hard day, and I think there will be some teams looking to split it up even early. So could be quite exciting. It's a good start, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and in relation to the sprinters, Marcel Kittel is not going to be racing in the Tour. That must be an immense relief to everyone who he's been beating first in the queue or most often second place, Mark Cavendish himself.
I think Cav has probably been not at his best form when they've been together. I think Cav is just probably the best at coming off a wheel that I don't know that there's ever been, really. He's so quick coming off somebody's wheel. It's hard to say, you know, exactly why Kittel does do so well, but I think technically Cav is a better sprinter. But maybe you're right. Maybe you know, in a pure drag race, Kittel's a faster guy. But, you know, don't forget we've got Greipel, Andrew Greipel, who is probably the most powerful of the sprinters. Whether he's got the beating of Cav this year, well, only time will tell. We'll see, won't we? So yeah. It could be good. I mean, some of the flat stages are going to be really good, I'm sure. And I know Cav wants that green jersey, so I reckon he'll be looking to try and win some of the intermediate sprints. You know, do the usual thing to get to Paris with that green jersey.
So we talked about the first week, that long traverse down the English Channel and Atlantic seaboard from Holland to Brittany. And then they do a big transfer in an aeroplane, and then they go back up the other side from the sort of, well, through the Pyrenees, Mediterranean, and into the Alps. I mean, it's a tour of two tours in a way, with a complete flyover of the middle of France, the central bit of France. Tours are becoming less and less like tours, aren't they, really? If you look back to, there used to be real circuits of...
Yeah.
And then they're more like little bits of string and spaghetti that are dropped in different places around the country. I mean, I guess it we can't go back, and there are lots of racing reasons why this new style of a little bit here and there and no real integrity to the route has developed. But it's tougher for everyone who's following the race, isn't it?
Well, I think it's a shame in some respects, because it does mean that they have less time in the Pyrenees and the Alps, which is obviously, you know, the classic hunting ground for Tour de France winners. And, you know, starting outside of the country, I mean, obviously it was great to see it come over to the UK, but, you know, there is a slightly cynical French supporting element of the Tour de France would say they'd rather have it all in France, which I can kind of understand, because the Alps and the Pyrenees, no disrespect to Yorkshire, but, you know, they are what the Tour de France is all about. And seeing the race, you know, spend practically a week in the Pyrenees is long forgotten. And probably some people are quite glad of that. I'd like to see more mountaintop stages, finishes, and, you know, a little bit more in the south of France. But there we go. You know, it's financial pressure. It's bringing the sport and the race to a bigger audience. That's what it's about.
At one stage, it was alternate years that the Grand Depart was abroad. And now we've had consecutive Grand Departs that's abroad. I mean, that seems to signal a change in policy.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're going to see more of it. to be honest. I don't know if they'll go to the other side of the world. I doubt it. But I certainly think that they're looking to spread their message further afield. So, yeah, I think it's inevitable now that we're going to get more of them.
You're listening to The Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston, talking with Guy Andrews about the 2015 Tour de France. Well, so much for the route, Guy. Let's turn to the riders, because they are the animators of the action. And we mentioned, let's really focus on the Fab Four, and then maybe a couple of wild card picks of yours of riders that you'll be looking out for. But let's talk about Nairo Quintana, defending champion Vincenzo Nibali, Chris Froome, and Alberto Contador. It does seem like it's been a long time since there have been four quite evenly matched but very different riders that doesn't point to a single clear favourite.
I'm racking my brains. I certainly think in the last 10 years we haven't had anything like this, probably in the last 20 years. So, yeah, it's an exciting prospect indeed. It places a lot of pressure on the individual teams. There's a couple of teams that have got a chance as well. You know, let's not forget there's a couple of French riders that have got a good chance of mixing things up too.
Who are we talking about there? Thibaut Pinot.
Thibaut Pinot, I think, has got, you know, he's got stuff to prove. I think also Romain Bardet. I always like to watch him race. And Jean-Christophe Perrault, the same team, they're on AG2R. So that makes them a very strong team. Although we talk about the Fab Four, I think there is definitely some teams that have got some plans to make trouble. So, yeah, all around it's going to be really exciting.
And will Nairo Quintana's teammate Alejandro Valverde, who may consider himself to be in some ways the senior rider, will he play Super Domestique, or will he sort of see how things are going to go?
No, I think he will play Super Domestique. I think he'd be stupid not to do anything other than that. I think the rewards for him would be far greater than him going for his own glory. Quintana there's probably not enough mountains for him. I think he'd like to see more mountains, but I still think he's got a great chance because of the lack of time trialing and, you know, the fact that Chris Froome, Alberto Contador would definitely exploit that and put a lot of time into him. So, yeah, I think if he gets Valverde working on side, he's going to be hard to beat.
Shall we go through the four and paint a little a sketch portrait of each one? Maybe, you know, something like a top trumps card, what you might find on, and, you know, their strengths, weaknesses, what kind of style of rider they are, what we should be expecting them to do, where they'll want to try and take time out of the other ones, and how all that interaction will work. Do we take them one by one? Who do you want to start with? We should start with the defending champion.
Yeah, defending champion, Vincenzo Nibali. I mean, for me, he's the greatest all-round rider of all of them.
Where will he look to attack? I mean, he'll look to stay up, right, when the others fall down.
Okay, exactly,
that's one thing. He'll look to attack on the descents,
yes,
won't he?
I think he will definitely be thinking about that, although, in fact, all four of them can descend really well. I think Nibali is the best of the four. He certainly will be looking for some crap weather in that first week. I think they'll be looking at the Mer de Huy stage, but also there's a stage a little bit later in Brittany that finishes at the top of the Mer de Bretagne. And in 2011, they finished up there and it did mess things up a bit. It's a road racer's circuit, that one, that particular stage. It's ideal for him. I mean, you know, he proved last year in Yorkshire that he can race on difficult technical terrain. And I think that's going to be right up his street. So I think he's probably got more options for attacking early in this race, definitely.
And his weaknesses, I mean, he probably can't stay with the crazy high mountain accelerations of the other three. We'll come to them, their different approaches to mountains in a minute. So he will be looking to kind of to defend a little bit on those pure mountain stages.
I think he proved last year that he's sensible. He doesn't panic. You know, he knows that these, you know, there are going to be these attacks, and he counters accordingly. So, yeah, and I think also his descending ability. I mean, I was looking at the stage to Alpe d'Huez, which is stage 20. There's no Galibier, but they're going to put in the Croix de Fer. Now, the descent off the Croix de Fer towards Alpe d'Huez is going to be ideal for him, because he gets that opportunity. He could probably let them go on the Croix de Fer and catch him on the way down again. You know, that's the kind of rider he is. So I think he's my I mean, it probably sounds fairly obvious that he's my favourite of all of them, but I think he's the best all-round road racer. So I think, you know, if things start to go awry from the point of view of drama, you know, from the point of view of weather and, you know, racing situations, I think he's the one who'll benefit
and
the
what
most.
And what are the chinks in his armour? I mean, we mentioned that he's not quite the explosive climber that the others are. But what else are his weaknesses? Is his team a liability? There may be several ways in which his team might be a liability.
I suppose it probably would be that. That probably would be the only thing.
From what dimension? Because they might suddenly get busted?
I wasn't going to say that, Jack. But yeah, I mean, who knows? I think
there is a cloud over this team for a number of reasons. They did have a couple of riders from his team that were his domestiques popped for EPO or something like EPO last year. They've got a fairly unrepentant, convicted doper as the head of the team. The youth team was in all kinds of trouble. They came very close to being having their racing license removed, didn't they? If what Brian Cookson says is to be believed. Where do you think they're coming from?
I think they probably had their knuckles wrapped. I think they'd be stupid to be trying anything like that again. So, you know, allegedly or not, Nibali's come out and been quite outspoken about the fact that he's not doping. It's hard to say that you believe people these days. I mean, obviously, we've been through so much of this, it's hard to know, but you just have to hope that he isn't, and you just have to hope that they behave themselves.
Okay, well, let's move on. Who should we talk about next? Alberto Contador, the winner of the Giro d'Italia in a spectacularly tough and punishing race that was, wasn't it?
Unbelievably tough, and that's going to be in his legs. So, you know, I think he will benefit from that because he's a class apart when it comes to stage racing. But I think it's hard to know, but I seriously think he's probably Nibali's biggest challenge. And for him, it's all about acceleration. It's all about timing. I don't think he's got any problems really with his team. I don't think he's got any problems with the prologue of the team time trial or anything like that. I think his probably his only weakness is himself and bad luck.
What do you mean by that?
He may have done too much already this year. You know, it's hard to say. What, you know, they come to these races in tip-top condition now, and doing a grand tour, it does take an awful lot out of them. So that might be the thing that does for him. I don't know. I mean, people are talking already that he's in the best form he's ever been in. So if that's the case, you know, he's going to win it. Yeah.
And he will have Sean Yates providing guidance from the team car, and Stephen De Jong, who are, they're both ex Sky, aren't they?
Yeah.
And but is Bobby Ulick in Team Saxo set up?
Yes.
Yes, he is. Yes. So there's a trio of former Sky backroom staff there. But they've lost Bjarne Riis, who had a bust up with the team's owner, the sort of maverick Russian Oleg Tinkov. Do you think that Oleg Tinkov is a liability for the team? Because he does seem to have a little bit of a testy relationship with some of his riders. When things are going well, he's your best mate. But when, you know, you have a bit of bad fortune or things turn against you, he's not the most sympathetic of bosses, is he? And it takes that stuff out into the public domain in a way that could really undermine a rider's morale.
If you follow him on Twitter, he's hilarious. My experience with Saxo is that they always have really good team morale. They all seem to be quite a tight unit. The riders are all, you know, sensible guys with experience. I mean, Chris Juul Jensen, the Danish rider, you know, he's a bright, intelligent, sort of down-to-earth kind of fella who, you know, who knows how to race a bike. So I think, and that's fairly common across the team. You know, that comes from Riis, though. I think Riis liked to pick those kind of riders, those sort of intelligent but down to earth and quite humble almost riders, rather than the big stars. And Contador himself is, you know, obviously he's a big star, but he's still quite a normal Joe. You know, he's quite a chatty guy. He's not a retiring kind of megastar. You know, prima donna, you know, he's not like that at all. So their team morale is one of the things that gets them through these things. So, you know, that whole kind of building a team from the ground up that Bjarne Riis was really good at, there's still a hangover of that. And I think Oleg Tinkov knows that.
As a rider, Contador, I mean, he's won everything. He's got a lovely style He's very fluid, good to watch. He has that sort of rolling shoulder dancing in the pedals style, which is in great contrast to the way Chris Froome, for instance, climbs. And it's always interesting watching the pair of them go head to head, as we have seen over the last few years. Where will Contador be looking to win this tour?
Probably Alp Duez. I don't know. I think Alp Duez is going to be the one that's going to kick off. Praloup as well, stage 17. I think that's going to be quite interesting. There's lots of little sort of vignettes going on in the mountains that where he'll be looking to attack Froome and Nibali, and also, I mean, obviously Quintana. But I think he's going to have difficulty shaking Quintana. I don't think he'll have difficulty shaking Froome and probably Nibali, but those guys can get back on again. I think Quintana's the one who can go with him and then attack again. So
that's interesting you should say that, because my impression is that in terms of the most punishing kind of fast accelerations on a climb, on a final climb of the day in the last two or three, maybe 5 kilometres, it's Chris Froome with these sort of crazy high cadence accelerations that he can drop anybody, it seems. And it seems like everybody else basically, if they can't stick with him, which most of them don't, maybe apart from Contador, have to kind of reel him in. And even Nairo Quintana, he doesn't seem to be that kind of explosive sort of 20-second attack. He seems like a little bit more of, I mean, it's ridiculous to describe him as a diesel, but he's more of a kind of constant power output climber rather than fast accelerations and then another fast acceleration.
Yeah, but I think that's the thing, is that Froome does tend to ride to a plan, and I suppose that's what, as a pure bike racing fan, that's why you've got to love Contador, because he doesn't seem to, you know, he seems to ride pretty much by feel, and I think that's the difference between the two. And I think the ability for Froome to put in those big attacks in the last 2K or whatever is because he's calculated that's what he can do. I'm not criticizing that. That's his way of doing it. But I personally like the guys that kind of tend to have a dig when you're least expecting them to. So, and Quintana definitely does do that. It could be one of those things where this whole thing just is a total stalemate, and they all come to the line together.
Let's talk about the other two now. We'll get onto them. Chris Froome, he's won the tour once. He is, as we were talking about, got this phenomenal ability to spin the pedals far faster than anybody else. And it almost looks like it's a computer game. When he suddenly goes into overdrive, he's like discovered some kind of special code on the Xbox where, you know, he can suddenly zip away from anybody. And it's a tremendously ugly on a bicycle. In a time trialing, he looks a bit better, but when he's climbing up a mountain, he's got his elbows out, he's all knees and elbows, but it's amazingly effective.
I think the thing that worries me about Chris Froome is he's so skinny. Looking at him in the Dauphiné just now, it's just like, he's just so skinny. I don't know, this is a completely different conversation, but I've been watching quite a lot of the old stuff from sort of the 80s, late 80s Tour de France's. And Le Monde, Eno, Laurent Fignon, those guys, they were people. I mean, they actually, I wouldn't say they had any fat on them, because they were all very, very fit. But they looked proportioned, you know, and it worries me. I have to say, the one thing that worries me about Chris Froome would be his whether he got sick or not, because I think they are pushing it a little bit too close to the edge. All the riders are, but I think especially Froome.
There was a quote from him talking about how he'd got really skinny and how it made him feel like he was going really fast. And then he also said this thing where he said that when you're this thin, when you eat a banana, you can kind of feel the banana entering into your bloodstream and putting all the energy into your limbs. I mean, I kind of, the image that I came up with was a kind of a long snake eating a goat. You know, those pictures that you got where they kind of unlatch their jaw and then you see this huge goat-shaped lump in the snake moving down. And I wonder if, you know, when Chris Froome eats that banana that he was talking about, you know, can you actually see the banana lodged sort of beneath his rib cage somewhere as it's getting digested? But that, you know, that is real borderline eating disorder talk, I thought.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't know, I do worry about it, I have to say. I mean, partly because I think, you know, I worry about it because I worry about the message it sends out to athletes.
It does seem to be Team Sky that are the guilty ones on this, or more guilty than all the others, because you listen to Geraint Thomas talking about, you know, how are you doing, Geraint? How's everything? How's your riding? And he's like, oh yeah, things are good. I've got really skinny. That's the first thing that they say when you ask them, how are you doing? I'm really skinny. Yeah. And even though he does tweet about having roast dinners or fantasizing about roast dinners and Welsh cakes and all the rest of it, but it's the same for all of them. And if you look at their Twitter avatar profiles, the sort of images that they choose of themselves, the Sky Riders, they often, I mean, Peter Kenyuk, I saw his image, and it's like this this kind of skinny porn of like, how skinny can you be? And it's obviously a way of showing that you're really ripped lean. And lean and all the rest of it, and it's sort of sending out a message to your rivals and to the public that you mean business. But it's slightly grim.
There used to be a sort of classic Belgian greeting, you know, when a DS or another rider came up to a rider and they'd sort of grab you around the stomach and give you a squeeze just to see, you know, how much you were carrying. And I think that was innocent enough. But I think what we've ended up with now is, I don't know, it does worry me, I have to say. Well,
let's move on from Sky's eating disorders or whatever we want to call them.
Having said that, I actually think one of Chris Froome's strengths is his team. I think Sky are, if you look at them on paper, they are probably head and shoulders the strongest team unit. And if they can pull like they pulled in the Dauphiné, I think he's got no excuses other than it's only going to be him that loses it, really.
And so what does a leading rider, what does a GC contender get from having a strong team? I mean, let's go through it. Clearly, if you've got a breakaway up the road that's looking a bit dangerous, you've got a good group of people to chase them down and reduce the deficit. What else?
More than anything, you've got guys around you who can keep you calm. I think, you know, Geraint Thomas is a great example of sort of he's kind of grown into this team captain sort of guy, but I think all of the riders on Team Sky seem to have that ability to stay calm. I mean, they've made mistakes, obviously, but they always seem to deal with it and come back stronger. So I think, I don't know, I think I think that's the thing for Chris Froome, is keeping him calm, but also not that he's a hot-headed guy, but I think that's the thing that the best champions usually have a right-hand man who can just say the right thing at the right time.
And the traditional that we've seen from various teams, various strong teams, I remember CSC doing it, Discovery and US Postal doing it before, of riding really hard in that sort of 30 to 40 kilometres or maybe a bit less into the final climb, burning off their riders one at a time to deliver maybe two or three for the final climb, and having done a lot of damage to the other teams, hitting that final climb really hard. Is that something that you like to watch? Do you feel that shuts down racing? Is that what we're going to see this year? And is it going to be Team Sky that's going to be doing it?
Yeah, probably. I personally don't enjoy the mountain stages for that exact reason. I'm sure when the Team Sky riders all form up in the autobus at the back of the race that they're hardly pushed by the other riders, because I'm sure that they don't exactly enjoy what they do just before the final climb. Having said that, I think it's a team event, you know, it's a team sport. So you can criticize it all you like, but that all they're doing is doing it the best, you know. Mm, I mean, it's up to everybody to be able to do that. It just so happens that Team Sky are particularly good at it.
It's always slightly puzzled me. Why does it benefit their rider as opposed to any of the other really strong riders? What's the particular advantage to your team and doing all that work? If you're if say we do have Team Sky doing it, then why is that bad for Nibali, Quintana, and Contador?
It isn't particularly bad for them, but it is if the team is so strong that they're shedding their own team riders, and that's kind of the main reason why they do it. You know, I mean, you know, cycling is about wearing the other teams down. That's kind of how it works.
So they're basically saying, look, we've got the strongest team. Yeah. We need to essentially show that. It's like in chess, if you exchange lots of pieces, if you've got a couple of a piece advantage when that exchange begins, ultimately it's going to count for all the more once you're down to a handful of pieces on the board.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the last the last couple of riders, you know, being as good as they are. I mean, Geraint Thomas is probably given up his best years to service other riders. And if an attack goes, he's still there to be able to counteract it, you know, counterattack or chase it down. So, you know, it's keeping some safety around the team leader. I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, having a chaperone, you know, because and preventing the other teams from doing it as well. If you've got two or three riders rather than one or two, you're immediately in a stronger position, and the other riders know that. So it kind of is a mind game as much as it is anything else, because if there are six Team Sky riders on the front still with 20k to go, it demoralises the other teams. You know, they look at it and go, oh, for God's sakes. And of course they drop it, you know, they drop back. So it has as much a psychological impact, I think, though, as probably it does a tactical one, because the teams do try and keep it as, you know, as close together as possible, so attacks don't go off the front, and, you know, a rider like Chris Froome can then launch his final attack with 2k to go and time it. That's what it's about.
You mentioned Chris Froome's perceived fragility, whether it's falling down on the cobbles or getting a cold and having to withdraw from the race. What's Team Sky's plan B? Because they have needed their plan Bs quite a bit in the Tour over the last few years, haven't they? Or at least as much as any other team. And in the Giro, Richie Porte abandoned. What is the plan B for Sky?
I've been critical about their plan B in years gone by, and I don't, that year that Wiggins crashed and broke his collarbone and the whole team waited back, you know, because he was looking like he was going to have to pull out of the race. And I think they had Thomas in the top five, top three. I think he was even third or something at the time. To me, that was just seemed to be a bit naive, because, you know, you've still got an opportunity to be up there in the race, although you've lost your leader. And I don't think they need a plan B, in fairness. I think their plan A, when it works really well. And of course, people criticise them because they do come and back one rider 100%. But I think that's what they need to do. And I think that's kind of, they've realised that's how you can win the race. So you can't really criticise them for that. Let's bear in mind one thing with Chris Froome. He didn't actually crash on the cobbles last year. You know, it was before they got to the cobbles. It was just, I think it was also, it was like slightly in anticipation of them, because the weather was so bad. And I think that that is going to be a huge governing factor in that first week. If we have rain in that first week, he's going to be really, really unsettled because of what happened last year. I mean, of course it's going to be in his mind. You know, looking at the cobbled section, there's only seven sectors on the stage that goes over the Paris-Roubaix course. There's only seven sectors, 13 kilometres of cobbles. And you know, there's one that's really bad, but I think generally speaking, he'll be all right on those cobbles as long as it's dry. If it's wet, I think the panic will set in, and I think that's where, you know, Nibali, for example, will be in his element.
Well, one thing we know about Chris Froome is that he will not be spending his nights in a motorhome, as Richie Porte did, to everybody's amusement. Although I enjoyed the Grand Tour motorhome Twitter hashtag and all the fun and japes around that, I'm glad that ASO have put their foot down and essentially said everyone's going to stay in the same hotel, and those are the hotels that are designated by the organisers, and that's that.
It's slightly ridiculous. I mean, no, marginal gains is their sort of thing, but you know what? You know, they don't have to do anything. You know, all they have to do is get in the lift and come down for breakfast. It's not, you know, it's not like they're doing their own washing anymore.
We're talking about cycle sport, but a lot of the time on the bike show, we're talking about cycling as kind of the answer to many of the world's problems in terms of congestion and the environment and all the rest of it. And it just sends out, I mean, the Tour de France does send out a lot of wrong and conflicted messages in terms of the role of the bicycle and sustainability. And it seems like everyone trucking around with their own mobile home in the race, that would just be a step too far in terms of really putting out the wrong message about what cycling is about and the place of the Tour in the larger picture of cycling.
To look at the Tour as just as the environmental footprint of it is alone is pretty terrifying. You know, I think the messages we need to send out need to be a little bit more inclusive and need to probably, I mean, I hate to say it, but they probably need to be a little bit more environment orientated as well, because it makes cyclists look a little bit like prima donnas, especially, you know, especially when they're sort of the rest of them have to do it differently. I don't know. To me, the whole thing was a bit of a disaster.
Well, what they were talking about was the idea that there might be 30 or 40 motorhomes going around within a couple of years, you know.
You know, there's 150 odd vehicles in the advertising caravan alone, and then there's probably the same amount that follow actually behind the race. You know, it does get a bit ridiculous. Yeah.
Okay, well, we mustn't neglect our fourth member of the Fab Four, Nairo Quintana, coming all the way from Colombia. What kind of rider is he at the minute? He's very good on the hills. We've talked about that a bit. Yeah. Maybe not quite explosive, but opportunistic and just with a huge engine, right?
Yeah. No, I think that's the thing. I think he can do everything well, in the same way that Nibali can do everything well. But I think Nibali is just a step up. That's all at the moment. I think there's room for improvement. I wonder about the team as well. No disrespect to them, because they're a good team. It would just be quite interesting to see what a rider like Quintana would do in a team like Team Sky if they were 100% behind him.
Mm.
That might put him in a very different position. I don't know. As I say, that's no disrespect to Movistar, but
yeah. You know, I mean, I quite like Movistar. I mean, they're one of the teams that I put alongside maybe Quickstep. In terms of teams that often come up with quite bizarre and convoluted but really interesting race plans, and I don't know whether they do that in advance or whether they're doing that on the road, but they often do seem to do quite clever things, sending riders up the road, kind of relaying and that kind of stuff. They don't always do the same thing over and over again, which is kind of what is the accusation against Team Sky, that it's basically the same race plan every day. There's a lot of racecraft there.
What I really, really like about Movistar is that 2 years ago now, isn't it, when Alex Dowsett rode the Giro, and they kind of rested him for a couple of days before the time trial, and lo and behold, he went out and won the time trial, beating Bradley Wiggins. And I just thought that was that sort of approach to it. Okay, they didn't win the race, you know, they didn't win the war rather, but they won the battle. I really like that approach. I really like when they play to riders' strengths rather than just use them up as cannon fodder. And I think that approach to bike racing, that sort of more holistic approach, I really approve of, I think. And you're right, Quickstep do that too. But, you know, where you can actually say, right, okay, we've got 21 stages, how many can we win? Rather than we've got 21 stages, we want to be on the podium in Paris.
Yeah.
There's different ways of looking at it. And I actually wonder whether Movistar have actually been, you know, fairly sort of pragmatic about this and thought, well, you know, Quintana could probably win 4 or 5 stages, who knows? But he might not win the race overall. But that will give us more than, you know, trying to win the race overall and him winning none. So, yeah. You know, it's that thing that, you know, that good teams do well, which I think as a bike race fan, you've got to look at and applaud, because to me, that's what makes certainly stage racing special.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think there's an interesting sort of back story or something that behind the scenes that is affecting this. And this is to do with the way World Tour points are allocated and the way that riders' contracts are constructed, and the way in which their bonuses and all the rest of that are paid out. So it can lead to a situation where coming 14th on GC is far more valuable in every way, whether it's a World Tour points or whether it's riders' own personal bonuses, which are often linked, than say 2 stage wins. That doesn't really come out in terms of our understanding or the general audience's understanding of bike racing and what's going on. It's like, okay, why are they not going for the stage win here? Oh, because they're conserving 18th place on GC. And it's the point? What's the point of that from a spectacle point of view? You know, I don't care who came 18th, but I remember that stage win 3 years ago because it's etched, you know, on my eyes. But whoever came 18th on the GC in that year's tour, I don't know, it's neither here nor there to me.
I'm yet to see any kind of brave steps forward from the UCI on this sort of thing, but I think they're going to have to do something about that, because that's the thing, you know, that sums it up really. It's ridiculous that, you know, you win a stage of the Tour de France is unspeakably hard to do. You know, I mean, you're talking about, if you win a stage of the Tour de France, you know, I wouldn't say you're made for life, but it's going to be a life-changing moment for any rider. And certainly for a lowly rider who probably is, you know, 20th, 30th, on GC, and for that to be ignored over, you know, being 5 or 6 places up on the GC in Paris is kind of stupid, really. I just think they need to look at that and just readdress it. I think this thing about points has always been a bit of a problem, and it goes back a long way. And I think it becomes a problem as well when with the doping issues that we've had, where riders are doping to maintain their position, not so they can win lots of races, but so they can actually just live, you know, so they can actually renegotiate their contracts. That's the thing that needs to be readdressed. In a sense, that's the thing that needs to be addressed, not the doping, for me. Because, you know, you're placing pressure on people that it's ridiculous.
What is the point of the World Tour?
I think it's a nonsense, to be totally honest. I think it doesn't suit cycling. It doesn't work for me. I don't think it really works in athletics either, in fairness. I think it's a bit of a mess. And I think it because it's a season-long thing, it becomes, in the days of Sean Kelly, you know, when the season-long thing actually meant that guys raced from, you know, February to October, it probably had some meaning. But I think now it's kind of meaningless.
I couldn't tell you who won the World Tour last year or the year before, or any year, I don't think. Do they get an award? Do they get a present? Do they get some money?
Do they get a badge or something? I don't know.
But
yeah,
the things
you're right.
That we care about are who won
Paris-Roubaix, who won Tour de France. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We care about people who crossed the finishing line first, ultimately,
yeah.
Don't we?
Yeah.
You know, or won the stage race. We don't care about some artificial points allocation. But what is driving this push towards a world tour? Is it the UCI that wants to harness the sport to its own ends?
Yes.
And are we seeing a kind of a battle here between the UCI, the teams, the riders and the race organisers for who owns and controls the sport and ultimately who makes money out of it?
I think it's a situation that we have, a similar situation that they had in Formula One. And in Formula One, when, you know, when Bernie Eccleston basically took over Formula One, he went to all the teams and he offered them a you know, a sort of a part in the spoils, and pretty much I think all of them refused. So he carried on, did it on his own, and lo and behold, he now holds all the cards, and the teams have to sort of, whatever he says goes. And I think that's the danger. I think we could end up, I mean, I know that the teams are trying to get together in groups, you know, to sort of forge alliances and promote cycling to a bigger audience. And I'm kind of in favour of that, but I also think that the UCI has been fairly self-serving, and I think that's the danger when you have politics and sport involved. It ends up being a bit cloudy and a bit difficult. So my view is the team should have more control of the sport, for sure. Definitely they should be more involved in the politics of the sport.
And does that mean they should be getting money from the TV rights? Because currently that goes to the race organizer, doesn't it, who sells the package of TV rights to the I mean, it also pays for all the coverage, but it ultimately sells the rights to the various broadcasters who then put it out on the airwaves.
Well, somewhat interestingly, this has only become a big issue right now when the sport is sort of very much on a, you know, having a sort of a crest of a wave. So, you know, I think if they'd been negotiating this 10 years ago, it would have been quite different, or even 15 years ago, it would have been very, very different. So, because back then there wasn't as much money in cycling as there is now. Mm. And with all these things, money's the thing that tends to govern the politics. I don't know. My views on it are probably slightly out there. I personally think that the ASO do a wonderful job of putting on bike races, but I'm not so sure that they're a brilliant political force in cycling.
What are they doing that you don't agree with?
They have too much power, and I think what they're really good at is organising bike races, and that's what they should concentrate on.
And what are they doing that they shouldn't be doing?
Well, I suppose they're only doing what Bernie Eccleston was doing, which is, you know, taking all the cash, I guess. It's bad for the sport on so many different levels. I mean, look at the state of grassroots cycling in France, for example. The women's tour is nowhere near where it should be. I mean, you know, and the thing is, when you have organisations like ASO and RCS making so much money outside, or supposedly so much money out of cycling, and they're not putting on events for women, and they're not feeding money back into the grassroots, yeah, I think there's a huge problem, because It's not just a men's game. I'm okay, we're talking about the Tour de France, which is a men's race. But I've just been talking to a photographer who's working on the 1985 tour when we had the women's Tour de France. I mean, there's no reason why the women's Tour de France isn't still running, other than the fact that there's no money in it. the races that are falling away, the smaller races that are still a part, or, you know, have been around for 100 years or whatever, that they can't put on anymore, that's the part of the sport that's suffering more. And I think it's their responsibility to keep that going, in the same way that they should have kept the Tour de France Féminin going, you know, 30 years ago now, and nothing's happened since.
Okay, so they should be organising some races which aren't quite as profitable, but are a good part of the ecosystem of cycling at whatever level, and whether it's men or women.
That sums it up quite nicely, Jack. Yeah, I think so.
You're still listening to The Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. Congratulations for listening this far. This does seem like one of those really long stages with crosswinds and
you should put this on whilst watching the television, which I think is what you're going to talk about next.
Yeah, Jack. we're going to talk about how to consume and enjoy the Tour de France. I mean, it started as a way of promoting a newspaper, and when I lived in London on the South Bank, I used to really enjoy getting on my bike in the morning and before I started my day's work, riding over to Covent Garden to a little international tobacconist, which did sell L'Équipe, buying my copy, picking up a coffee and a croissant and reading it through with my pocket French dictionary for any of those words that I didn't really understand. Although I fast learned that a lot of words that are used in cycling in French have a particular cycling meaning that's different from the meaning that you get in the dictionary. So it was often a little bit difficult. But I really enjoy the newspaper side of things. I can't read L'Équipe here in South Wales, unfortunately. Nobody sells it around here. But most of us are consuming it on the television. I mean, it's been since the 1960s, a television sport, not a newspaper sport primarily. But do you think that the television coverage is as good as it could be? I mean, that does sound like a leading question, and I guess it is. How can we improve the television coverage? What is wrong with it, and what needs to change?
That's a tricky one. I think the coverage itself, I think the camera work and the pictures that get sort of transmitted to our living rooms is improving, you know, year on year. I mean, it's getting technically amazing. You know, I mean, some of the stuff you get now from the tour is pretty incredible. I think this new approach to putting cameras on bikes is quite interesting, although I haven't yet seen anything that I find as exhilarating as a camera on a motorbike going around the Isle of Man TT course, or even a camera on a Formula One car. So I think they've got some work to do with that. I think it's a lot down to where the camera is positioned on the bike. But anyway, I'm sure they'll work that one out.
And it's never been done live, has it? Am I right in thinking? It's always done after the event. It's like a couple of days later, you know, and then it's like, well, the moment's gone now, isn't it, really?
Kind of. And I think that's the thing. I think if you could actually have the live, and I think that's obviously what they're going to be working towards. I actually think live sound recording from the Peloton could be quite interesting. But anyway, because I'm sure there's some choice things that happen in the heat of the moment. But from a commentary point of view, I think when I first started watching cycling on Channel 4, when Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin first started commentating, they just had this sort of gravitas and this sort of knowledge that you just trusted. And I think partly because Paul Sherwin was an ex-racer and a very sort of intelligent team captain style bike racer, that transferred across to the expert analysis that he gave. I think as time has gone on, the sport's changed. I think for him, that's been, you know, it's been a sort of a transition to a new group of summarizers, professional summarizers, including, you know, Sean Kelly, Brian Smith, and now David Miller. I mean, Roger Hammond's done a bit. Magnus Baxter does bits from time to time. I think recently, Ned Bolting and David Miller did a wonderful, you were mentioning this earlier, Jack, when we were first speaking about their commentary for the Dauphiné was really good and very insightful. And I think that's what we're missing. I think we're missing more of that. I think the insight into what is actually happening in the race is only stuff you'll only get out of riders like David Miller and Roger Hammond, because they've been there and they've done it. So
I would absolutely endorse that. And particularly David Miller, he was a nice team with Ned. But he was saying some things which really had never crossed my mind, and some things that I'd never heard before. I'd never heard anyone in that position saying it, and it kind of made everything make sense. And he was almost predicting things that were about to happen, and then they happened. He was like reading the race, and I'm not the biggest fan of David Miller in lots of ways, but I had a whole new respect. Well, I've always sort of kind of respected him, as I think you respect anyone who's gone through a whole career of bike racing for the sheer toughness of what they've done. But I really thought that he was, you know, doing something extremely well. And I think, you know, it would be terrible if he goes into a fashion brand or clothing like that. You know, there are a ton of people who can design better clothes than David Miller. And I think he has no place doing that. That's just madness. And I think he, as an observer of the sport and as an interpreter of the sport, whether it's in print or, which he's always been quite good, whether it's on the web or in newspapers, but particularly in this live commentary on a race, I just thought it was exceptionally good. So well done, David Miller. That does beg the question, do you think that ITV will get rid of Phil and Paul, who are just, they're just way past their shelf life, and they've sort of been tarnished by their association with Lance Armstrong and their strong defense of Lance Armstrong until he confessed. I just feel they can't bring them back. It's madness to bring them back. It's almost unethical to bring them back.
I don't know. I know Phil Liggett very well, and you know, I know that he's still passionate about cycling. You know, whatever you say about his stance with Armstrong and obviously Paul Sherwin's as well, you know, they're still both very, very passionate about bike racing. And I think that doesn't leave you. I don't know. I think it's difficult because commentating for that amount of time, you go back and you think about David Duffield, you know, going on about cheese for ages. I mean, I actually used to quite like that in its sort of quirkiness. But I actually, funnily enough, you know, if you do go back and listen to some of the old commentary on some of the older bike races, certainly from the late 80s, I think when Liggett and Sherwin were at their peak, if you like, there was a lot more insight. I don't know what's happened really. I think it's maybe you're right. Maybe they're just they're there's time to move on.
How else can you follow the Tour de France? Obviously, the social media is all out there. Quite a lot of the riders are on Twitter. I don't think they say an awful lot that's particularly interesting on Twitter. There's quite a few blogs out there. I always have a look at The Inner Ring.
Yeah,
I find that an insightful blog. Anonymously written. We don't know who writes it, it seems to be very well informed and quite thoughtful and interesting as well. There's the cycling podcast. Lionel Burney was often a regular on the bike show, but has gone off and set up shop elsewhere with Richard Moore and Daniel Freeb. And they, I think, will be doing a daily podcast. And that's always interesting. The ITV cycling podcast is you know, usually filled up with the best bits from the TV show, plus a few outtakes. And Matt Rendell appears on that along with Chris Boardman, Ned Bolting, and sometimes Gary Imlach, if he's available after his TV stuff. And there's an awful lot of cycling media, isn't there?
Yeah, and it's growing. I mean, that's you know, it's good to see. It's good to see. I mean, following the tour is, I mean, I always say the best thing to do is go, you know, but following the tour from home is, I mean, you get to see more of the action. But strangely, this year I'm not going on the tour, which is the first time for probably about 15 years. So it's going to be quite unusual for me.
So what are you going to be doing this summer, Guy?
Well, I'm working on a couple of books. I'm working on a book with Thames and Hudson Publishers about the Magnum photographers, of which I worked with a few when I was in my days at Ruler. And it's a very exciting project, but it has taken up an awful lot of time because I've been interviewing quite a lot of photographers and chasing around Europe to find them all. So it's been, it's been fun. It's been really good. It's hopefully it's going to be a really good project.
Well, so that's going to be a photography book of these Magnum photographers who are the top photographers of all kinds, you know, reportage when they've gone to a bike race,
and some of the stuff is quite extraordinary. I mean, it's actually interesting to say, which we haven't mentioned yet, it's 30 years since a Frenchman's won the Tour de France this year. So one of the stories that I've been following is John Vink's coverage of the 1985 Tour, which he covered for Libération newspaper, and I was talking to him about that this week, which was really quite fascinating. And a very interesting approach to photographing a bike race, which, you know, no matter how far back you go, there's always been reportage photographers at the Tour de France, and some of the best, you know, Henri Cartier-Bresson, Martin Frank, Robert Capa, Guy Le Querac, Harry Gruyart, you name it. There's a long list of very, very, very talented photographers. So, yeah.
Great. Well, when's the book out?
Next year. I've got to get it finished first. So that's okay. One of the reasons why I'm not going to the tour. Right.
Terrific. Okay. Well, I don't really like to pick winners and things like that. But I'd like to ask you, who would you like to win? And who do you think will win?
Oh, crikey. I'd really like a Frenchman to win, I have to say. Partly because they need to win the race. You know, they really need to bring it back home sort of thing. So I'd love to see a Frenchman win.
Any kind of Frenchman, or have you got one in mind?
Roman Bardet or Thibaut Pinot. I mean, I'll take any, to be honest. Whichever. I can't see it happening, though. So I think out of the Fab Four, I would go for Vincenzo Nibali.
If I asked that question to myself, I don't think I could answer, but I would agree with you on having a French winner, because I think they would go nuts, and I think that would be a good thing for the race and a good thing for France. I'd quite like to see Geraint Thomas. I know he won't, but this is not who I think will win. I would, if it's not going to be a Frenchman.
You're an adopted Welshman. I suppose it makes sense for you to go.
Yeah, I'd like to see a Team Sky Plan B come together somehow for him, and I guess the only way he could do it is by doing some insane, getting involved in some insane break, one of those 10-minute breakaways that somehow manages to vault himself to the top of the GC in a single day. I mean, that does happen from time to time.
Yeah, it has happened, and it would be a delicious irony, wouldn't it, that they took such a risk that they did something like that. And it worked, because that is as far from marginal gains as you can get.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Guy. It's been comprehensive pre-tour analysis. And dear listeners, if you've stayed with us this far, you've done extremely well. So go off and pour yourself a long, cool drink and get back to planning your consumption of the Tour de France. You've been listening to The Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. My thanks to Guy Andrews for sharing his expert insights and opinions. You can keep up with Guy by following him on Twitter, where you'll find him at The Coureur, T-H-E-C-O-U-R-E-U-R. And you can, of course, follow me on Twitter at Jack Thurston. The music that opened and is closing this edition of The Bike Show is by Menschmaschine. It's their reworking of Kraftwerk's 1983 Tour de France single and appears on the album Handwerk, alongside a dozen other jazzy Kraftwerk cover versions. Look out on the podcast feed over the next couple of weeks for the next edition of The Bike Show, where I'll be reporting on the most interesting and useful bikes that were on show at the Bespoke Handmade Bicycle Show in Bristol a couple of months ago. Until then, thanks for listening. Goodbye.